The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Georgine Rice, and it's great to be with you. This week, after the Mueller report, the U.S. Attorney General appoints an attorney to look at the origins of the spying, or shall I say surveillance, of Donald Trump, the candidate.
Sure enough, the FBI had sent an undercover agent to try to tease information out of George Papadopoulos.
We'll look at the crisis in Venezuela and the efforts to help the victims, Venezuelan citizens.
For the past 3 years, we've been getting food into Venezuela. We've been doing that through a church network.
We'll share an update on a pastor in India who is accused of forcible conversions.
They were held there for 3 days and three nights, being beaten, stripped off their clothes.
And a look at one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a Christian, Nigeria.
You can get killed in Nigeria for being a Christian for multiple factors.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, coming to you from my home station at KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time on 93.9 KPDQ here in Portland and online at kpdq.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin in Washington, D.C., and the latest on the origins of the Russia collusion story and the spying or surveillance of Donald Trump, the candidate. Byron York has been closely following the story from the beginning. The chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner joined Kevin McCullough, my colleague in New York, on AM 570, The Mission.
So why did Attorney General Barr refer this case to the Connecticut DA?
Well, I think he did it because clearly there are things that need to be investigated. When the Attorney General talks about spying on a campaign, you know, shortly after he said that on Capitol Hill, and there was a big uproar about it, we learned that, wow, sure enough, the FBI had sent an undercover agent, a woman who went by the alias of Azra Turk. They sent her in summer of 2016 to London to try to tease information out of George Papadopoulos. So just, you know, days after the Attorney General said there'd been spying on the campaign, well, we found out about a spy they sent over to keep track of Papadopoulos. So certainly there's that. Then the question is, who could investigate that? And we've all heard about the Inspector General of the Justice Department, who has been investigating this for more than a year now. And there are two issues that make additional investigation probably necessary. First is the Inspector General's probe might be narrow or limited in some way that we don't really know. It might be narrowed to, say, the FISA application, the wiretap application that was put on Carter Page.
Right.
Now, that's something we need to know about, but it's not the whole story. But the bigger thing is that Horowitz, the Inspector General, is not a prosecutor. He can't use a grand jury, he can't subpoena people, and he can't talk to people outside the Justice Department. So, for example, if the CIA were involved in this, and of course they were, we know that they were certainly involved in keeping track of what the Trump campaign was doing in Russian with Russians in the 2016 campaign. Horowitz, the Inspector General, really couldn't go after that. And a U.S. attorney, John Durham from Connecticut, can indeed go after that. So I think that's the two big reasons are one, to make sure the scope is wide enough to investigate everything, and two, to be able, you know, jurisdictionally,
right,
to go outside the Justice
Subpoena Department. Subpoena power and jurisdiction matter, because there could be a whole litany of people that might fall outside the parameter of what Horowitz would be allowed to look at then. That really
That's
is helpful,
right.
Byron. Now, you wrote a very interesting piece, and I want people to understand what you're saying, but the FBI, the grief they're getting, they've kind of earned. This is your position, right?
Yeah, they have.
I mean, trying to simplify it down to one statement, it's kind of, you kind of got what you paid for here.
I have to say, I was looking, as a result of, you know, just every day looking into this stuff, I looked back at the October 2016 application for a wiretap on Carter Page. So this is the FBI asking the secret FISA court for permission to wiretap Carter Page, which
right.
was granted and renewed, by the way. And I thought, well, you know, we can now look at what the FBI asserted in that application, what they said about Carter Page. We can now kind of check that against the Mueller report, which we now have. So we can see, well, gee, was it true or not?
Now, don't tell Jerry Nadler. He's not aware of the fact that the Mueller report is now available. But everybody else in America is. So go right ahead.
Yeah, I got a copy right on my laptop.
I'm saying.
So, you know, and so I did, and basically it just does not look good for the FBI. Here's what their argument was, which is that Russia was trying to influence the 2016 election. That was true. That Carter Page had a history of business dealings in Russia with Russians, and that was true. And then their third assertion was that Carter Page was a Russian agent working with Russia to undermine the 2016 election, and that's where they went completely off the rails. And as evidence for that, they cited stuff straight out of the Steele dossier. They said that when Carter Page was in Moscow in July 2016, and we know he was there, he went over to give a speech, and there was newspaper coverage of it, so that's publicly, factually known. When he's over there, they say he has the dossier. He said he had a secret meeting with a man named Igor Sechin, who was head of Rosneft, which is a giant Russian oil and gas company. And the dossier said that they planned a quid pro quo by which Page would be given a lot of money in exchange for a President Trump dropping U.S. sanctions on Russia. Now, that was never proven. I mean, Page said it never happened, and nobody's ever presented any evidence that it did other than the dossier. And so they include that in the dossier. It's kind of like Exhibit A for why they should wiretap Carter Page. And now you can go back and say, well, gee, what does Mueller say about that meeting? He doesn't say anything. Nothing.
Whoa.
Okay. The next thing in the FISA wiretap application, they say that Page also secretly met with a man named Igor Divyekin, who was a senior member of the Russian government and an associate of Vladimir Putin. And you think, wow. That's big. Let's go see what Mueller said about this secret meeting with Divyekin. It's not there. It's not in the Mueller report. It didn't happen.
We'll turn now to Venezuela, a nation in crisis. Nicolas Maduro was first elected president in 2013. Since then, the socialist strongman has succeeded in taking what should be one of South America's richest nations and running it into the ground. The economy is in shatters. The people are starving. The people want opportunity, but first, they just want to eat. Many are fleeing into neighboring Colombia, and ministries like Giving Children Hope are there to help. Sean Lawrence from Giving Children Hope was a guest of Craig Roberts on KFAX in San Francisco.
It's remarkable to think that this nation that sits on the largest oil reserves in the world, they should be one of the wealthiest nations, and yet the people can barely find enough food to survive. What's going on?
It is mind-numbing what you're sharing. I was just in a meeting yesterday with Bonnie Glick. She's the deputy administrator of the USAID, and she said there's not even one functioning x-ray machine in the whole country of Venezuela. And you talk about the amount of wealth and the resources they've been sitting on, but the mismanagement of the country has led to the place where there's not one functioning x-ray machine in the entire country.
And we know certainly everything from food shortages, toilet paper shortages, hospitals that have no medicine. They can barely keep the lights on for multiple hours in a day. It seems as if this nation is unraveling at the very seams. And yet Nicolas Maduro is insistent on staying on and insistent on helping to build up the straw man and suggests that everybody else on planet Earth is responsible for the decline of his nation. Yet the two people most responsible, and that, of course, will be the late Hugo Chavez and this bus driver turned president. We talk about the circumstances being dire. There have been, as I suggested, a number of people that have just simply given up and fled. They have no other option. It is estimated Ecuador alone is dealing with a refugee crisis of between 750,000, maybe up to 1 million people. And that certainly has been the conditions in many other surrounding countries, like Colombia, for example, reeling from trying to deal with this humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, it's true, Craig. I've been at the border many times over this past year, the Colombian-Venezuelan border, and at the public crossings, when they cross over, the first thing you hear people yelling for is, "We buy hair, we buy hair." And so, people are so desperate just to buy food with the medicine for the children that the first voice they hear when they come across the Colombian border is somebody offering to buy their hair. So imagine the other offers that have been whispered to them as they come across, but it's that level of desperation is, as you said, you talked at the very beginning, seeing beggars on the streets of Latin America. This is unheard of and unseen of in this area before.
Certainly in the midst of this crisis, one of the big challenges has been the fact that Maduro has consistently turned away help of any sort, most notably from the United States, although ironically he's had an open arm policy for the Russians, though seemingly only to invite military aid to help prop up his failing regime. What, from a practical standpoint, is being done by your organization in specific, Sean, to help deal with this refugee crisis and assist people in countries like Colombia, for example, that are there, they're displaced, they have friends and family back at home, they don't know what the future is going to look like, they're pretty desperate. How can we help?
Yeah. Well, people always kind of seem to look to the government for these types of things and solve these problems, but we've been, for the past 3 years, we've been getting food into Venezuela. We've been doing that through a church network, both through the Protestant church and through the Catholic church. The roots and the network they have in the communities, their reputation in the communities, they've been able to get food in both through neighboring countries and then directly from Miami into Venezuela. And so, the risk that people are willing to take, the level of desperation is so great, but this has been a great opportunity for the church in Venezuela to rise up and to cash in the equity they have in their communities and to serve their communities. And so even though the government is failing them on a scope, that we can't even comprehend, it's been a great opportunity for the church in Venezuela with support of the church here in the U.S. to rise up and fill that gap. And so we, with the support of the church here in the U.S., have been able to get food in for the past 3 years and are continuing to. I'll actually be leaving tomorrow evening to the border again and just making sure that those routes are still open. And the church has come up with some really, really creative ways to bypass some of these government restrictions. But I think the church is always at their strongest when they're being persecuted. So it's been a beautiful thing to watch in the midst of this horrible crisis.
If you'd like to learn more about this work, go to givingchildrenhope.org. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they're preparing leaders for the public square. It might be the right step for you or the recent college graduate in your life. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, a pastor imprisoned in India.
They were held there for 3 days and three nights, being beaten, stripped off their clothes, even abuse.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. India, the world's largest democracy, is currently in the midst of elections. They'll select their new parliament and their next prime minister. Fueling the rise to power of the current prime minister, Narendra Modi, was the BJP political party and the RSS volunteer organization. Both are arms of the growing Hindu nationalist movement in India. We should know election results next week. What we know today is this. Hindu nationalism has contributed directly to the persecution of Christians, particularly Christians bold enough to talk about their faith. In the state of Uttar Pradesh, northern India, Pastor Balu Soste was jailed for allegedly forcing conversions. Andreas Tonhauser of ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, has been helping. He gave an update to my colleague Don Crow on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
Would you take us to India and this particular case? Kind of give us the backstory of what happened to this pastor and why, and why this is good news, in fact.
Sure, I'd love to. So a year ago, I was able to travel to India, to Madhya Pradesh. It's a state in India, and it's almost desert there. And we went to a very remote village to meet a pastor called Pastor Balu, his wife, and his six-year-old son. And the first time I saw them, it was first his son called Ruben. He came through the door, and leading into the room, he was his father and his mother, who are both blind. And his father is a pastor of a very, very small church in Madhya Pradesh, in a village with maybe 30 to 40 faithful. However, one day, 3 years ago, they were attacked by a violent mob, beating up the people praying with the pastor and the pastor himself. But then they did not only beat them up, but they took the pastor, his wife, and the son and brought them to the nearest police station. And there, not the attackers were held, but the pastor and his family were held at the police station, being indicted for forcible conversions under India's Madhya Pradesh's anti-conversion laws. They were held there for 3 days and three nights, being beaten, stripped off their clothes, even abused, and terrible things happened to them until finally our partners in India, lawyers, were able to intervene and get them free on bail. But there was a case ongoing against this family, against the pastor, for forced conversions because he allegedly had given someone money to convert to Christianity. Until this week, it was found that all the allegations were baseless and the facts that were brought forth were proven false. So this court case was finally eventually defeated by our partner attorneys in India.
Now, you've already alluded to that, Andreas. It's trumped-up charges. In other words, they're accused of something that really isn't true, but it's enough to bring them into court and bring them under police arrest in cases like this. So it's fairly common that this kind of punishment is being used against them?
Unfortunately, yes. It is fairly common, and we see an increase in this. Our partners recorded they have a helpline for Christians in India who are facing attacks. And they've recorded in the first quarter of 2019, they've recorded more than 80 violent mob attacks. That means almost every day there has been an incident where mobs have attacked Christians, either individuals or whole groups, which just shows that that there is an increase, really. And we see an increase in more than 20 or 30% compared to last year on those attacks. And, of course, most of those attacks are not being reported to us. But even with India being a huge country, this is a very concerning development that we're facing there.
From India, we'll turn now to Nigeria. Some of you will remember the story of the schoolgirls in Nigeria, where in 2014, more than 200 of them were kidnapped by the Islamic terror group Boko Haram. Then First Lady Michelle Obama famously pleaded their cause with the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. The story may be out of the news, but the environment in Nigeria is no better. It remains very dangerous for Christians. Don Crow welcomed Nigerian human rights attorney Emmanuel Ogebe into his studio.
For folks who hear Boko Haram, what is that and what's happening?
Yeah, now Boko Haram is actually has over the past few years been the deadliest terror group in the world. A lot of people thought that was ISIS, but Boko Haram actually outdid them and was number one for several years. And then to make matters worse, Boko Haram has pretty much split in two, and one faction has merged with ISIS. Mm. So the most effective arm of ISIS in the world today is in Nigeria. They call it ISIS West Africa, and that's the terror group that is holding Libya. But just to provide a bit of quick context on Nigeria, Nigeria has been dubbed the deadliest place in the world to be a Christian. You can get killed in Nigeria for being a Christian from multiple factors. And so that's why it has that unfortunate title.
Now, Libya was, as I recall, the one Christian in a group of girls that was abducted a few years ago. Talk us into that story, the history of her experience that's put us where we are today.
Yeah. Now, Libya was abducted in February 2018 with a bunch of her schoolmates. So over 100 of them were abducted from their schools. Now, why this is interesting is that in 2014, Boko Haram went into a community in Chibok and abducted 276 girls. Now, this was a Christian community, so overwhelmingly, over 90% of the girls were Christians. Boko Haram abducted them. About half of the girls are back, but over 112 girls are still missing 5 years later. So that was horrific, and no one thought that lightning would strike again until February 2018 when terrorists went to a school and abducted over 100 girls on February 18, 2018.
And that's when she was taken?
And that's when she was taken.
Now, how is it that are all 112 of those girls still missing?
No, here's the thing. And this is really interesting. I do a lot of work with victims in Nigeria. And as soon as the girls were abducted, I reached out to my contacts. Let's investigate this. Let's see what's going on. And they quickly came back to me and said, Emmanuel, there are 39 Christian girls in that school, and we've accounted for 38 of them except one. And this was within less than a week after the abductions. I said, who is the one? They told me her name is Leah. A couple of weeks later, so I called the mom then, I consoled her. A couple of weeks later, my contact called me, and this is a young man who had been, his throat was slit by Boko Haram. He recovered miraculously. And he says to me, they call me Dad. He says, Dad, these girls are going to be released. I said, why? Why do you think so? He said, well, they mistakenly took a bunch of Muslim girls, and their target was Christians. So they're going to release all the girls.
That's where she ended up, the one Christian.
And, you know, when he said that, I was like, I mean, hey, 4 years later, the other Christian girls are not back. There's no way that these girls will come back. And within a month, Don, I kid you not, 100 Muslim girls were returned. Yeah. The one girl that the terrorists kept back was the one Christian girl, Leah.
Coming up, we'll learn more about this courageous young Christian, Leah.
Her classmates tell us they were all asked to put on hijabs, and she didn't. And the terrorists asked why. She said, well, I'm a Christian.
Stay with us when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Affliction, adversity, persecution. These are not things that we ask for. For many of us, it's the stuff that we fear. We wonder, how would we hold up in such circumstances? How would I? Sometimes it's the powerful example of the faithful in extraordinary circumstances that serves as an inspiration for believers around the world. I think that's the case of Leah Sharibu. Let's return for more with Don Crow with Emmanuel Ogebe.
I have said it from this microphone to others of you who have expressed it to me privately. It's one of those tragic situations that the mainstream media seems totally ignorant of, willingly so, intentionally so, if you will. But there's a particular case that we're talking about today, this young lady, Leah. So if you would tell us about her and about what you're doing right now on her behalf.
Yes. So Leah is kind of, you know, the silver lining in the really dark cloud of persecution that is overwhelming Nigeria. The news of Leah really struck a chord with the world. A lot of people have responded to her story. At 14 years old, Leah was confronted by terrorists. How it began was her classmates tell us they were all asked to put on hijabs, and she didn't. And the terrorists asked why. She said, well, I'm a Christian. Everyone thought, you know, and you're refusing to put on a hijab? Mm. And so, you know, they got to the terror camp, and apparently they brought, you know, her classmate said to her, look, you got to say you're a Muslim so that you don't get into trouble. And so she refused. The next thing, an elderly man was brought to come and talk to her, wise counsel, girl, this is the right thing to do. Mm. I'm a sage. I'm advising you, put on. And she said, I'm not. I'm a Christian. I'm not going to. And they were so upset that they took her to the camp commandant, the head terrorist, and said, we have here a Christian girl who is refusing to convert. And the commandant said to her, what is this I'm hearing? Is it true? And she said, I won't deny my faith. And so from the very beginning, she was outed.
And so now how are you able to find out anything about her at this point? Is there recent information about what's happening to her now?
Well, there hasn't really been any information since last year. There were only two pieces of information that came out. One of them was a proof of life audio recording that Leah made to the world. And, you know, this is what is amazing about this girl. In that recording, she said, you know, you guys should take care of my family. And I said to myself, how could a prisoner in captivity, her first concern is for her family that is outside in freedom?
You have actually called upon President Buhari on her behalf, probably not once, but maybe several times. Talk about that and how the government's responded, if it has, and if not, why this is allowed to fester and go on without governmental dealing with it.
Yeah, well, of course, it's an optics nightmare that the government negotiated the release of 100 Muslim girls, and over a year later, the only Muslim Christian girl is still not back. And they don't seem very concerned about it. In fact, it took the government probably 8 months before they finally contacted Leah's family. 8 months. Now, I had gone in, I had met her mother, and I even arranged for her mother to meet with international delegations. So foreign officials met the mother before the president of Nigeria even bothered to call. He hasn't met with her.
Yeah.
So that's the difficulty that we've had.
Now, again, Buhari, as I understand it from material you provided, has made a promise that he would, of course, politicians can say that, and that's as far as it gets. He would do all he can.
Yeah.
In fact, I guess told even her mother that. Is there anything that listeners here in the U.S. can do, even via the Nigerian embassy here, on her behalf?
Yeah, listeners here can call the Nigerian embassy's phone number in Washington, D.C. and ask that Leah should be brought back. They can also call the White House and ask the U.S. to put pressure on Nigeria for Leah to be brought back. Call your congressman and say what is being done about Leah. Leah, it was 14 years old at the time she was abducted, and she stood for Christ. She's now 16. Every day she's paying a price for choosing to still be a Christian.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they're preparing leaders for the public square. It might be the right step for you or the recent college graduate in your life. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, faithful Christian witness right here in our country in changing times.
With meekness and with fear, we're called and commanded to defend the faith against all opposing worldviews.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. As we hear stories of Christians going through harrowing trials around the world, we are well aware of the very significant shift we're seeing right here in our own nation, where the pressures to compromise our faith are growing. Social media, the onslaught from the elite media outlets, and even government coercion all contribute to the pressure to conform to the new norms. In the face of all of this, we do well to consider what faithful Christian witness looks like today. Author and speaker Sonny Hernandez of Reforming America Ministries joined Lee Michaels on AM 980, The Mission, in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
You know, standing strong and defending our Christian faith, what do you see as one of the biggest issues that you see or are facing us as a church or a body of believers today?
In that perspective, I say one of the biggest factors that every Christian has to have in a restricted institution is their subservience to Christ, their affirmation of Scripture being the inerrant and infallible Word of God, and number three, the issue of avoiding compromise, which that's why I bring up those three things together, because, you know, understanding the nature of the role and how the culture has been a big impact in our surroundings. That's why I'm quick to bring out that every Christian is required to maintain that integrity to Christ, because we're called to be ambassadors for Christ, not mm-hmm. to be politicians.
And, you know, when we see that and think about it, we look at the culture today and kind of this pushback on Christianity. And it's a topic that comes up a lot, because all of us as Christians seem to face it at some point or another. It might be in a conversation at work. It could be a conversation with a family member. It could be what we see in the media or social media. And being able to stand firm on God's word, to share the gospel, and at times might not always be easy, but being in those discussions and to do it in a way that can be winsome, but that can speak truth with a capital T, we need to encourage each other through that.
Oh, absolutely, sir, most definitely. And in fact, I would often appeal to a known passage in the text of 1 Peter. With meekness and with fear, we're called and commanded to defend the faith against all opposing worldviews, and we're to do it in meekness and with love. And ultimately, what I tell everybody is that when you're talking to an individual who is not a born-again believer, it's not uncommon that they're going to bombast the Christian, or they're going to say pejorative terms, or they're going to allege that somehow we're being unloving or mm-hmm. we're anathematizing them. And I would say, no, we're not. This is not spreading hate, it's spreading hope, because there's only hope in Christ. And unless they understand that, unless they inculcate that it is the message of the gospel that saves, again, that is their only hope for all of their maladies, and they must understand that. And that's why I say the only way they're going to know that is if the preacher tells them the truth.
We come at it a lot of different ways now, and how we as Christians are attacked, this kind of Christophobia that is out there that attacks us, in being able to stand strong. For some people who are well-grounded, it's a little easier than others. But what are some of the tips or things that you can help people with on a daily basis when they see something or hear these things or words spoken or memes that are shared or things that come against Jesus or attack us as Christians?
The way a lot of individuals work is they operate under fear. Now, here's the big one, and it's a big legal term. It's called the heckler's veto. In other words, out of fear that somebody is going to complain, make a threat, or become offended, what do individuals typically do in senior positions? They typically suppress the right or the religious liberty of a Christian to propagate the truth, that those inviolable liberties that God has given to them, and that an incalculable amount of men and women have died to secure. The other thing I wanted to point out is just be mindful, too, that when you're talking to unbelievers, they have a different worldview than us, so you have to be ready to combat that. So if I wouldn't mind, sir, I'd like to give you an example.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I meet individuals that profess to be atheists, but I argue there's no such thing as an atheist. Now, here's what they'll typically do. If I say, okay, Mr. Professing Atheist, here is a Bible, and this is my authority, and by the way, you have to tell me what your authority is, which they claim they have no authority, so that is their authority, that they have no authority. And when you're talking to them, I say, okay, look, you look at me and tell me what you see, and I look at you and I'll tell you what you see. I would look at them and say, you are made in the image of God. God imbued you with a living and reasonable soul. He indelibly engraved his law into your heart and made you in his image after his own likeness. They're going to look at me and say, nope, you're just a chemical accident that happened a billion years ago, protoplasms, atoms banging around, or molecules in motion. But here's the problem. We're both looking at each other. We both see the same thing, two human beings, but we have two different presuppositions.
Right.
I'm looking at things through the biblical lens. They're looking at theirs through a professing atheist lens. Therefore, that's the malady that exists between myself and them, and that's the reason why we have to preach the gospel to them.
Amen to that. I know terminology is a big thing. I remember being in a conversation. I've brought this up in the past of somebody talking about, you know, we're all sinners. We understand. And they looked at me and said, well, I'm not an evil person. And, you know, sometimes we get caught up in our Christianese, and when we understand, and so I realized, oh, my idea of understanding what sin is as a believer is different than somebody who isn't a believer. When I said sin, they automatically thought they were an evil, bad person. When I say, no, we all have a sin nature, we're all have a tendency to sin. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It just means we have the sin nature that only Jesus shed blood can save us from. And so when we get into those conversations with those who are unbelievers, sometimes being on the right terminology and understanding, just like you said, that framework or their worldview can really go a long way into help us being honest and truthful and sharing the gospel.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about that, right? I'll tell you what the Apostle Paul said. In Romans, he said, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God.
Amen.
Pretty simple text that I think all of us know right now. Regardless or irrespective of whatever world religion an individual allegedly affirms, here's what I tell them. Okay, look, you want to know the nature of your sin? Okay, do this. I want you to take a piece of paper, and I want you to write down every wicked thought, every wicked deed, and every corrupt act you've ever committed in your life, and I want you to put it in an envelope. And by the way, you're going to probably need more than one sheet of paper. And I want you to send it to the police department, but put your return address on it. Isn't it quite plausible? You're probably going to have a SWAT team waiting outside your house.
Yeah.
And of course that's the case because, again, we don't have to be taught how to sin. We sin because that is part of our nature.
Yeah.
And that is the reason, again, why we must continuously make the Savior known to individuals. And so a great topic to bring up, the topic of original sin, is the today when people ask the question, is why do all these bad things have to happen? And immediately you have individuals like the professing atheist that will try to judge God of being the perpetrator in the act when they fail to miss the point that it's because of sin. Death and through sin entered into the human race, Romans 5. And I think the Bible is unequivocally and patently clear on that topic, that it's because of sin.
Coming up, slavery today.
The retriever would go and negotiate a release for a slave.
And a ministry bringing freedom. When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Slavery. We'd like to think that it's just a part of the past, one of the darkest chapters in our own nation's history, but something that's done. But that is far from the case. Slavery, I am very sad to say, is still alive and well. Bob Burney from WRFD, The Word, in Columbus, talks about the efforts of CSI International with Kevin McCullough.
The slavery in Sudan is incredibly serious. Huge numbers. I don't think anyone can really give a proper estimate. But CSI is involved literally in freeing slaves.
CSI takes on kind of two different tracks of their work. Dr. John Eisner, who's the founder and the longtime voice and face of the ministry, interfaces with a lot of government leaders. And so he's regularly in world capitals pleading with governments to try to intervene and to get some of these injustices stopped. And then their U.S. operations, that's kind of headed up by Joel Vanderspeck, is really on the ground providing the aid and the essential legwork that has to be done on the freeing of individual slaves. But in terms of Sudan itself, they've been there at least 30 years, and they largely worked under the radar when they first went in with people that were of Arab background and Muslim persuasion, but that people that wanted to have a good relationship with Christian communities in the southern region of what was then a unified country. They would work with those retrievers to build a network, if you will, sort of like the Underground Railroad here in the U.S., the retriever would go and negotiate a release for a slave. When the war was ended, there was a lot of hope. A lot of people thought, oh, the war is done. Now the slaves will come home. But what instead happened was the world governments got them to divide the two countries to bring about a peace. and forgot that the slaves were still enslaved. And so as a result, none of the finishing touches of the war even addressed the slavery issue. So it's been as important now as it was before the end of the Sudan War to go and get these people. The process by which they do it, Bob, is really beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. So they have these slave retrievers is basically how they refer to them as. They're people that go into the northern Sudan region. They locate slaves. They identify who the slave owner is. They begin a conversation with that owner. The slave owners are largely cattle ranchers. Because of the drought and the circumstances there, they've had a hard time with their cattle surviving the recent years. And so there's a vaccine that is very, very beneficial to the cattle called Movidium. Christian Solidarity International has figured out how to get a hold of that cattle vaccine, which is very prized by the cattle rancher. So what they, in essence, do is they say, we'll promise a vaccination for this cow if you'll release one slave.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Follow us on Twitter at TC Outlook. That's TC Outlook. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posehn, and Mike Cook, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.